From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, our latest Project Milwaukee series gets underway. We'll get an overview of a long-term project on black male incarceration.
They're the questions that have been with us for a long time, and we've got to break the cycle. We've got to get people interested in finding solutions.
On Veterans Day, a new photo book documents the Stars and Stripes honor flights that take World War II veterans to Washington. Plus, a Milwaukee writer's novel tries to keep another World War II story alive.
This book is a way for me to pass on this information, these stories, to another generation. And it's something that can be lasting. I mean, this book can last forever.
And we'll head out to the endangered Soldiers Home on the grounds of the Milwaukee VA. Lake Effect is next after the news. It's Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thanks so much for being with us today. Today marks the beginning of our latest Project Milwaukee series. WUWM, in conjunction with Milwaukee Public Television, is undertaking an in-depth, long-term examination of a breathtaking statistic. According to the most recent census, Wisconsin has the highest rate of black men in prison of any state in the nation, about 1 in 8. And in Milwaukee County, the numbers by just about any measure are staggering. More than half of the African-American men in their 30s have spent part of their lives in prison. Over the next 6 months, Lake Effect, WUWM News, and MPTV programs such as Adelante, Black Nouveau, and 4th Street Forum will explore the cost to the men themselves and the community and to the state at large. To look ahead more closely at the series, I'm joined by Project Milwaukee executive producer Annalise Hensel, reporter LaToya Dennis, and Everett Marshburn, producer at MPTV. Nice to see all of you.
Thank you.
Thanks
for inviting us.
Everett, what was it about this topic that Milwaukee Public Television is especially interested in?
Well, Milwaukee Public Television is interested in Milwaukee and Wisconsin, and certainly when issues affecting our community are brought to the forefront like this one has been, it's something we need to get involved with. As a producer of Black Nouveau, I'm especially concerned because more black men being arrested means they aren't able to support families and do the things that we want citizens to do.
LaToya Dennis, you have been wanting to get at the subject for a while. What was it about this topic that especially spoke to you?
You know, for the past 4 or 5 years, I'd been going back looking at the recidivism rate for the 53206 zip code, and that's really what got me interested in looking at the larger picture. And for me, a large question is, what happens to the families? We talk a lot about numbers, but there are personal stories there. So what happens to the families when these men are in prison or in jail? And what happens to people who are in the same age category as these men who want to start families and, you know, with people who look like them and those are their options?
Everett, these are the same questions that Milwaukee Public TV is interested in answering?
Absolutely, they're the same questions. And they're the questions that have been with us for a long time. And we've got to break the cycle. We've got to get people interested in finding solutions. And that works both ways. They're institutional issues, but they're also personal issues and things that people have to do, things that men have to do.
Annalise, this is format breaking a little bit for Project Milwaukee. We have in the past devoted a week to covering a subject, but we're talking about 6 months. Why are we dedicating so much time to this?
This is a really complex situation with many reasons for its existence and many impacts. There also are many potential solutions to the problem. As Everett was mentioning, there are grave impacts on the men that are involved that are incarcerated, as LaToya said, that are that recidivate and end up back in the cycle of incarceration and can't break out. This is something that affects them. It affects their families, their neighborhoods, the larger community, and the economy. A lot of researchers who look at this topic say that there are thousands of men that are taken out of the economy because they are in the prison system instead. This is something that we feel that we can't do justice to in just a series of reports over the course of a week where we set out to say, we'll look at this aspect of the problem this day, this aspect of the problem this day, and this aspect on that day, and then we'll wrap it up. It's something that we feel we will really be able to dig into as we get out into the community more, hear more people's stories in weeks and months to come, find out what we don't yet know about this topic, and bring those reports to our listeners and to the viewers on MPTV. So that's the main reason for stretching it out over time. It's a really big issue, and it demands that sort of coverage.
Why were you so interested in working with Milwaukee Public TV, and Everett, why were you so interested in working with Milwaukee Public Radio?
This gives us an opportunity to expand our audience. I think that there are a lot of people that will hear stories on our air and will point out the fact that MPTV is doing related coverage. They'll then go to MPTV. They'll learn more about the situation in stories that are related to ours but are taking on different aspects of it. Same thing with the listeners, or viewers rather, of MPTV that see something there and learn that we're doing related reports. We'll play off of each other and we'll be able to do double the coverage to double the number of people.
Everett?
She answered it perfectly. Let me just explain. This sort of came up because LaToya and I were talking, and here we were, two African-American journalists, and when we got the report, she had one thought about it and I had another, but we ended up talking about it and said, well, you know, we ought to do something about this. Mm-hmm. And why don't we do it together? Because we represent different media, and that would really be a way to maybe make a bigger impact than any of us could make by ourselves.
And if I understand correctly, there is going to be some cross-pollination, if you will. LaToya, you're actually doing some reporting that will make its way onto television. And obviously, Everett, you're here with us today.
Yes, I am. And yes, she will. She'll be doing a segment for us on Black Nouveau.
Everett, talk about what we're first likely to see as part of this series on Milwaukee Public Television. How is the story likely to play out at the beginning?
Well, what we're going to do in the first week, Adelante is going to do a piece on Project Return, which is a program that helps inmates get back into society. Fourth Street Forum is going to talk about building a safe community for all, because there are some communities where people don't feel safe, and we have to look at that and deal with it. The following week, Fourth Street Forum is going to talk about race and gender bias, which certainly plays into this as well. First week on Black Nouveau, we're going to air a piece that the BBC did about the high recidivism rate, because it's an excellent piece, and we could do a piece on it, but we'd be duplicating that, and we've gotten permission from the BBC to air that, and LaToya will be joining us to talk a little bit more about that and some of the things that WUWM is going to do.
Annalise, obviously, this is one way we're starting our coverage on WWM. There was also a piece that aired this morning as well. Talk a little bit about the beginning of coverage of this issue right here on our airwaves.
The goal of this first week is to set the stage and to remind listeners, if they have forgotten or if they missed it the first time around, of some of the staggering numbers that are in the UWM study that came out earlier this year.
This is the Lois Quinn study.
Yes. We're going to be talking about why the numbers of black male incarceration are so high in Wisconsin, dramatically high compared to the rest of the nation, when that happened, and what are some of the policy reasons and legislation reasons for that, as well as some of the social and cultural factors. And as you mentioned, we have new segments running today, Wednesday and Friday, as well as Lake Effect segments, all three of those days as well. And we'll be sprinkling in some additional reports in weeks to come.
LaToya, are there really big stories that you're especially eager to tell in the coming months?
For me, important questions are, you know, where is society failing? But not also society, where are we failing ourselves? And by that, I mean, where does personal responsibility come in? And okay, so what happens after prison? You know, you've done your time. What do you do next? Because so many people talk about how difficult it is to find employment and just to get that second or that third or that fourth, however many chances it is that you need. So where do you go from there?
This is absolutely coverage that I know on Lake Effect we're looking forward to over the coming months, and we will be watching and listening closely. Everett, LaToya, Annalise, thanks so much.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Everett Marshburn is producer of MPTV's Black Nouveau. LaToya Dennis is a reporter in WUWM's newsroom. And Annalise Henzel is executive producer of Project Milwaukee. Our series, Project Milwaukee, Black Men in Prison, continues on Lake Effect Wednesday with an interview with UW Milwaukee's Lois Quinn, who co-authored the study that quantified the data. You'll find more at WUWM.com/Project Milwaukee. A quick break now, and then we'll shift gears to Veterans Day in a new book that documents the Stars and Stripes honor flights transporting Wisconsin World War II veterans to Washington, D.C. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. Today is the 11th of November, the day we customarily honor the people who have served in the armed forces, veterans of war and peacetime service. For almost a decade, a group of volunteers has undertaken the task of allowing veterans of World War II to visit the Washington, D.C. monument honoring their sacrifice. Since its inception, the Stars and Stripes Honor Flight has flown more than 5,000 veterans from around Wisconsin to Washington. It's a moving experience for the veterans and for the friends and family who welcome them back at the end of the day. The full experience is captured in a new book of photographs called Honor Flight, A Visual Journey. Honor Flight founder Joe Dean joins us, along with photographer Courtney Lutz, book editor Renee Riddle, and Dan Buttry, president of Fisher House Wisconsin, which shares in the proceeds from the book. Welcome to all of you.
Mitch, great to be here. Thanks. Good to see you again.
I think people appreciate the concept of the honor flights, what they set out to do and what they accomplish. But do you think – is there an untold story of the honor flights that this book can help tell?
Wow. There's so many untold stories, Mitch. We were recently with a survivor of the USS Indianapolis, and it's a long story. But of the 1,200 men on board, 900 made it into the water. And after 4 days and nights of essentially shark attacks – 317 came out, and we met one of those heroes at a recent honor flight event. And after he told our story and we thanked him for his service, he said, you know, I think about those guys every single day. And he shook my hand and he said, but you know what? Freedom is worth it, isn't it? So that's kind of what we feel at Honor Flight. We're losing these heroes, 900 every single day, and we believe deep in our souls that freedom is worth it, and we need to do everything we can to thank them and honor them.
And I think the beauty of a photography book is to really capture those unseen moments that may slip by. Honor Flight is about a big homecoming, a big send-off, and a lot of people have seen and experienced that in Milwaukee. But what a still image does is it captures those quiet moments of reflection where our veterans are just staring at the memorial, holding hands with one of their escorts or guardians. And from the power of that image, you really get a moment of what they're thinking about, what they're remembering that happened to them 70 years ago, and how these trips bring back those memories for them.
And as the photographer, it must be a delicate balance between wanting to depict these very personal moments but not wanting to intrude on them. Do you worry ever that the lens is intruding on those moments?
No, not at all. I think that there's so many times throughout the day that we can be right next to the veterans, and they're very welcoming and thankful that we're there capturing the homecomings.
Yeah, and I think because Courtney and her team are with us from early in the morning, this day starts at 4:30 in the morning, and, you know, it's going through this big experience together. We're on a plane, we're waiting in lines, we're on the bus, and there's a rapport that develops throughout the day. So really by the middle of the day and by the end of the day, they feel like they are really good friends with the photographers who come with us.
Mitch, one of the things – I mean, we're so pleased to be partnered with Visual Image Photography, Courtney and her team. You really recognize when somebody's heart is in these pictures, and this book is a work of art and a labor of love from the people at VIP. And one of the things we learned along this journey through these pictures particularly was that as important as it was to thank these veterans, that we better never wait 70 years to thank them again. And that's one of the reasons we're so pleased to be partnered with the Fisher House right here in Wisconsin.
Well, right. And so why does Fisher House feel that it's important to be a partner with the Honor Flight?
Earlier this year, Joe and Renee reached out to us and said, look, we have to do our mission. We're going to continue the mission with Honor Flight. But we understand the pressing need in Milwaukee for the construction of the first Fisher House in the state of Wisconsin for these current veterans. Well, correction on that. all generations of veterans. And so it's not only the current combat soldier who's coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, but it's also the World War II Korean Vietnam veterans who are being treated at the Milwaukee VA. And so it really was a way to bridge the gap of generations between both organizations, but also to deal with a more immediate and pressing need that is currently serving a cause and a mission for our current military and veterans.
Now, you mentioned these really kind of solemn moments along the way, and I'm sure they're really happening all the time. But one of the things that struck me in looking at many of the pictures is that while it is a solemn occasion at its heart, many, many of the veterans that you're bringing to Washington look like they're having a terrific time.
That's the best part of the day, are the surprises from when they are getting to the airport in the morning and there's people there welcoming them and helping them. And then they get to Dulles and there's a huge crowd at Dulles. And it just keeps happening. Even at the World War II Memorial, people, random strangers will come up to them and greet them and thank them. And those are the special moments and those are the happy moments and all the way to the end of the day.
Some of them look like they're really hamming it up.
They do. You're going to see a lot of smiles with each page turn in this book. I think some of the most powerful images, too, are the ones that connect the generations. There are so many kids and young people who are really, really connecting to this greatest generation. And to see the signs and the hugs and the tears that they have for these heroes, it's really overwhelming. And we can't totally explain it at Honor Flight, but it's amazing that through the power of the lens, we've been able to capture it.
So many of these veterans have never talked about their experience before. And they join us on an Honor Flight, and it becomes this fountain of youth where they really revert back to the 18, 19, 20-year-olds they were when they defended this nation. And we find that that's very cathartic. They begin sharing stories first with each other, and then ultimately we hear from their families that when they get home, most of them for the first time in their lives begin to also share their stories with family members.
Well, and it seems remarkable that, I mean, for all the stories we feel like we have heard about World War II, there are so many more stories that we haven't heard.
That's right. And again, one of the reasons we're so pleased to be working with the Fisher House is that Fisher House talks about families' love is good medicine. And bringing these families together is really a part of the healing process, and those stories are also shared with each other at the Fisher House, right?
It is, and there's been a development as we've been moving forward with our capital campaign for private funds in Milwaukee to build the Fisher House at the Milwaukee VA. It's an interesting connection between recent passing of some of these veterans, because what will happen is there will be gifts made in honor and memorial, and we receive those, but they're also accompanied by handwritten notes of these family members of these World War II veterans and these Korean and Vietnam veterans. But there were a couple notes that came in from a veteran who passed away from Cudahy, who was in the Battle of Midway on one of the carriers. And these are our neighbors. And very few people knew he was here, about his story, until he passed. And then they selected Fisher House to be their gift in memory of their father and their grandfather because of the honor. And I will tell you, it's a powerful moment when you get this note from a spouse and saying the love of her life has passed, but she loves and honors everything that he represented for her and the nation. And so you can see it's a natural connection between what the Honor Flight's doing and honoring World War II and now Korean veterans, and then what we're doing to support them now with the need of coverage, health, you know, while they're getting their health and treatment at the VA so their loved ones are close to them.
There is a moment depicted in this book. It's a photograph from Arlington National Cemetery of I think she was a World War II nurse who had dressed up to visit her late husband, thinking of it as going on one last date with him. And it was hard to look at. It was so moving.
Yeah, that was Lucy Cohen. She was an awesome individual and spent a lot of her formative teen years, late teen years, on the front lines in Germany in a ward for what we would now call post-traumatic stress disorder individuals. And it changed her life. She came back to work in the mental health field. But that's a very powerful picture.
What was the greatest challenge in both turning this into a book and turning it into a book that was not 10,000 pages?
It was very difficult. We started with over 15,000 images from the last 5 years of honor flights. And it took us months to cull through these images and pare them down. And I still think there's about another 1,000 that we could have added.
<That's right.
laughs> The cover image, I think, says it all. You see a whole row of sailors from Great Lakes Naval Base. They come up and they've been doing this for many of our homecomings. These young sailors volunteer their time, they come up and they'll stand in a solemn salute, and our World War II veterans get to walk through this row of saluting sailors, and wow, is that a moment. And I've seen many a World War II veteran come off that plane and just have to stop, wipe away the tears, and they salute back. And those of us that are volunteering or the guardians to these veterans, that's a powerful moment. And that's why we picked it to be the cover of this book.
Yeah, there's some great behind-the-scenes pictures that most people never see about Honor Flight. And Renee mentioned, you know, the sense of community and how the community came together. That really is also the story of Honor Flight. This way, we started with a brat fry, right, and raised $250. And as this book goes to press, we've flown 5,000 veterans from around Wisconsin, and that's in thanks to 600 volunteers and just the remarkable support of this community. I think we really touched a nerve because this is everyone's history.
A perfect note to end on. Thank you to all four of you. Best of luck with
Mitch,
this book.
Yeah, I just want to add, Mitch, that again, thanks to Dan and the Fisher House, half the proceeds from this book will go toward building this Fisher House. I think we're going to try to break ground in the spring, correct, Dan?
April, May is the timeline that we'll be breaking ground.
So we need to raise significant money to help our partners at the Fisher House. No one will regret owning this book. They will pass it on from generation to generation. We're a 100% volunteer-run organization, and 50% of all the proceeds will go to us to continue to fly veterans, and 50% will go to the good people at the Fisher House.
Well, Joe, Dan, Renee, Courtney, thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Joe Dean is the founder of Stars and Stripes Honor Flight. Dan Buttrey is president of the board at Fisher House, Wisconsin. Courtney Lutz is a photographer whose work comprises the new book, Honor Flight, A Visual Journey, and Renee Riddle edited the book. There's a link to more from the book, including how to buy it, from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. A novel also works to connect modern readers to the World War II generation through a real-life newsletter printed in Milwaukee. We'll learn more about it when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Mitch Teich. The honor flights we heard about before the break pay tribute to a generation that is fading from active memory, that of the soldiers who fought in World War II. The book that documents those flights will help subsequent generations remember those stories. So will a novel called Don't Let Down by Milwaukee and Elizabeth Mullins. Mullins culled the real-life newsletters produced by women, including her mother, from St. Matthew's Parish on the city's south side. The newsletters featured both updates from the home front and news about parish members serving overseas in World War II. In fact, some of the chapters in Don't Let Down start with quotes from letters home printed in the newsletter called The Apostle.
I guess the Army is the greatest travel agency in the world. Let's pray they've bought us all round-trip tickets.
The fellows walk up the church aisle to receive communion, with helmets in one hand and rifles in the other.
Don't let down, and don't think it's all over. It's not, and there'll still be a terrific struggle and much hardship before we see the end of it.
Betty Mullins joined Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce and described what sorts of items were typically found in the newsletter.
They reviewed a play that they had just put on, and they reviewed a book and gave a list of books that were available in the library that they ran. Then they advertised some coming events like, you know, the Boy Scout hike or the concert that's coming up, or this group is having a card party on this night. And then they reported on how the Girl Scout cookie sales were going and that the Altar Society had elected new officers. And then they had at least a couple pages of just little one- or two-sentence paragraphs reporting on at least 30, 40 of the men. Sometimes something as simple as so-and-so's at this fort and he's in radio school. And others it was so-and-so was wounded and he's recovering in Australia. There was one guy who was complaining about KP duty, and he wrote, "Damn the potato, whoever invented it." And a couple of fellows were stationed in England, and they would write that they are taking a class at Oxford, or they went to this pub that Charles Dickens used to frequent. So those little tidbits of news on all kinds of different fellows from all over the world. And then actually they had an in-depth interview once in a while. If somebody was home, maybe he was injured, maybe he was through with his service. And they would go into a little more detail about what his experiences had been like.
Why did your mom and these other ladies feel that this was important to put out this newsletter each month?
I think they were motivated by, patriotism and love for the people, from their parish that they knew. They wanted to participate in the war effort, and I think they wanted to boost morale. And they wanted to give their people a connection to home. I think that's what motivated them.
Did you get a sense in reading the newsletters what this information from home meant to the soldiers?
Oh, there is not one issue that doesn't contain at least one thank you from these guys. They appreciated it so much. Well, I forgot to mention the name of the newsletter was The Apostle, because they were like spreading the good news just like the apostles who wrote the Gospels. And this one person wrote, "The Apostle, like the Pacific Ocean, covers the miles between us and those we love."
Mm.
Those were the kinds of comments these fellows would write in their letters back to the staff, or sometimes they wrote them to their family and the family gave them to the staff. But they were absolutely appreciated.
Did your mother ever talk about her work with the Apostle?
She didn't. At least I don't remember her talking specifically about having made these newsletters during the war. But I must have known something about them, because when I discovered them, I knew what they were. After my mother died, I was looking through her things, and I found a full set of issues of this newsletter. They published this once a month from 1943 to 1946, and she had every single issue. And it made me realize that she kept them because she was proud of them, and she should have been. And because that was a very meaningful time in her life.
Why did you choose to take these newsletters and then fictionalize them in this novel, Don't Let Down?
Even though I knew like maybe 20, 25 of these people who were talked about and who put the newsletter together, I didn't know of anyone who I knew to be still alive. And I thought it would be too daunting a task to try to track down actual participants and interview them for more information. I also felt that there was such a treasure trove of information already in them that I almost didn't need to. But the other reason for fictionalizing it was so that I would have the freedom to pick and choose real stories and mix and match them and recombine them into characters and situations that I thought maybe would make for a more interesting story. I mean, these are interesting, believe me, but I thought I could improve on that. And I could also fill in the gaps with my imagination.
You told me a story before this interview. There was, in fact, an instance where you did fill in the details, but it took you hunting down what actually happened, that sometimes the newsletters would mention something and you would find it didn't include all the details.
Exactly. In fact, generally that was true. There was like surface information and cute little stories, but not whole histories, except once in a while, if somebody had an in-depth interview, they might have gotten a fuller story. But there was a fellow from St. Matthew's who was shot down over Germany in May of 1944. And the newsletter told us that he was missing in action. And then a few months later,
it mentioned he's still missing. And then in December of 44, it reported that he was home for Christmas and so happy to be there. I realized I was going to have to develop the facts and fill in a lot of gaps if I wanted to tell that story. And it was intriguing. I thought it must be an interesting story. So I went to the UWM Periodicals Library and looked up the man's obituary because I knew who he was. I learned from the obituary that he had been in a B-17, and I thought this was interesting and clever. He had avoided opening his parachute to the last possible second so that he would be more likely to be missed, you know, not be seen. And it must have worked. And he had somehow escaped out of Germany into France, which was at that point still occupied, but not for long. And he had worked on farms and orchards. He had played deaf and mute when he had to. So that was wonderful additional information, but I still needed to fill in the gaps. So I began doing some research, maps and guidebooks and books about the war, in order to find a place in France that was liberated as late in time as I could find. And so I found this village in northeast France, and so I had him shot down near there, and I imagined how he escaped and imagined how he was sheltered. And then I just went back to the real facts of in mid-October, this village was liberated by the Allies.
I just think it's interesting that you're taking some of these stories that, even though they've been so well preserved in these newsletters, you're bringing them to light for a new generation. What does that mean to you?
Well, that you know, you learn things when you write something like a book. And among the things I learned was that the more vividly you keep a memory alive, the closer it is to you. And that even though information like this, stories like these, dilute with each generation, they will never be forgotten as long as somebody remembers. And so this book is a way for me to pass on this information, these stories, to another generation. And it's something that can be lasting. I mean, this book can last forever.
You also chose to include actual quotations from mm-hmm. some of the letters and some of the newsletter articles. Why did you choose to do this? And you know, as you were fictionalizing the story, why did you choose to include these real words?
Well, because they were so impressive. That's the short answer. I was so impressed with their humor, their eloquence, they were so deep and profound, I just couldn't resist. So I just thought it would add to the book to have these wonderful quotes introducing chapters.
There's a difficult moment at the beginning of the book, toward the beginning of the book, where the young women learn of the first death of a young man from their parish.
Yeah.
What was it like for your mother and her friends to try to report that news?
Yeah, I'm sure it was difficult because the first man who died, his sister worked on the paper. I can only imagine, because, of course, they didn't write down how they felt. But I can tell you that that's one thing I do recall, is my mother often remembering that man, the first man from their parish who died, and she always looked very wistful and sounded very wistful when she remembered him. When that first death occurred, they devoted a full column on the front page to the story of his life and the story of his military service. And they mentioned that the family had received a letter of condolence from General Arnold. But they also printed in that issue a letter the family received from his chaplain. And that letter from the chaplain was so much more personal and so much more revealing of the man. And then, of course, they had a memorial mass for every person who died from St. Matthew's. By my count, there were 15 men who died from the parish.
I would imagine that reading these really gives you a snapshot of how communities throughout the United States reacted and coped with the war effort. With the reality of war going on with their loved ones fighting overseas. What did you glean from reading about how St. Matthew's dealt with this experience?
Well, let me say that at least one person in the course of these newsletters mentions that, you know, gee, thanks for sending the paper. I really appreciate it. I love reading it. And lots of churches do this. And we pass them around like mad. I mean, they don't even care if they know anybody in the newsletter. They just want to read about home, you know. But the sense I got was that I was reading the experience of people who were putting their faith into action, using their faith to illustrate and interpret and survive these very real and dramatic times. I mean, how do you cope with that much death? You look to God. You pray for strength. I think that's how they reacted, and I think that's what they did.
Why was it important to you? And what do you hope readers get from reading Don't Let Down?
I did want, generally, to have readers really feel like they understood what life was like in that place at that time. And I think I've succeeded in that regard because a number of people have said, that's exactly what you did, you know. And I've even had people who were alive then say, everything you write about in this book, I can relate to. It all happened, and that's the way it was. So I did succeed in that. Beyond that, I would say that I did want to pass this on, share it with another generation and pass it on, and hope that someone else does the same thing so that these memories of these wonderful people and the wonderful things they did will live on.
And in this case, you aren't just talking about the soldiers. You're talking about the young women who preserved all of this.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I want them to be remembered as well because this was a wonderful thing that they did. They really participated in the war effort by doing this wonderful thing to connect their people back to them while they were away.
Betty Mullins, thank you so much for sharing the details of Don't Let Down with us.
Thank you very much for having me here.
Milwaukee writer Elizabeth Mullins' novel is called Don't Let Down. It's based on newsletters produced during World War II by women such as her mom at St. Matthew's Parish on Milwaukee's South Side. Mullins spoke with Stephanie Lecce. One last break, and then a trip to the historic but endangered Soldiers' Home on the grounds of the Milwaukee VA Medical Center. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. More of Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Milwaukee's Soldiers Home was founded in the wake of the Civil War to care for injured and recovering veterans. Today, the site spans 90 acres on the grounds of the Clement Zablocki VA Medical Center and is the oldest remaining soldiers' home in the country. While many of the historic buildings are still in use by the VA, several have fallen into disrepair. And a recent report by the National Trust for Historic Preservation reiterates the call to preserve what it describes as national treasures. In recent years, efforts have been underway to preserve these buildings through the National Trust, the Wisconsin Historical Society, and other local and regional actors. We've been tracking those efforts, and recently the Soldiers' Home launched a walking tour smartphone app to draw residents out to the site to see these historic buildings. Jim Drager is the State Historic Preservation Officer at the Wisconsin Historical Society, and he took Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce on her own tour of the grounds to see what progress is being made.
Many people know of the Soldiers' Home, but very few have seen it. Most people's experience with it is seeing it from the parking lot of Miller Park when they're tailgating, and they look up and say, oh, what's that building up there? But to come up here, you see this very impressive group of historic buildings that are some of the finest architecture in the city of Milwaukee.
So let's start here with the building we're standing right in front of.
Sure.
What used to be housed here, and what's the new plan going forward once the preservation is complete?
Okay.
The building that we're looking at is what's called Old Main Hall here. It was originally built as a domiciliary to house veterans of the Civil War. When this complex was established in 1867, right after the war, because it was realized that there were so many injured, disabled soldiers as a result of the war that the government had to do something to try to help these people. And it's the beginnings of the veterans care system that we have today. So 2 years after they established the VA hospitals, this building is built, and it's built to house veterans who are not able to go back into the general public because of the severity of their injuries or the amount of care that they needed. And so they stayed here in kind of barracks-like housing to receive the treatment that they needed.
What's the plan going forward?
The plan going forward is uncertain at this point. What we know is there is a need to have these buildings reoccupied. Exactly what that use will be hasn't been determined yet, but it's the most important historic building on the campus, and it's enormous. Looking at it, you see a very massive building, but I think what helps radio listeners understand it is it's 170,000 assignable square feet. So it's a gigantic building, and it will take gigantic uses to fill it.
The building is closed right now, but it looks like on the outside, at least, there's a lot of renovation detail going into it. What else has to be done on the inside?
The inside is surprisingly good condition, considering it hasn't been used for quite a while. There will certainly be work that needs to be done to this building. It'll have to have a new roof. Masonry will have to be tuck pointed. It will need all new utilities on the inside of it. It'll have to be cleaned out. Spaces will have to be renovated for new purposes and new needs.
While the renovation and the project planning is going on, how are you utilizing these buildings as they stand right now to bring the story of Soldiers Home alive?
Well, we're really trying to celebrate the history of Soldiers Home. Soldiers Home has recently been declared a National Historic Landmark, which is the nation's highest honor for historic buildings. It means that it's one of 50 properties in the state of Wisconsin that are considered to be seminal properties in telling the history of the United States. The Soldiers Home here in Milwaukee is the most intact of all of the VA hospital complexes in the United States. It's got most of its original buildings left here. And so we're trying to tell that story of continual veterans care over the years. I think, as we think about our veterans' needs today and people who served in World War II or Korea or Vietnam or Afghanistan, Iraq, we're very aware of that story of the need to care for veterans who have put their lives on the line to serve our country. What we help to tell in this story is that this story has roots that go back deep into history, and that the Soldiers' Home is the place where this kind of thinking about caring for veterans starts.
And how are you getting that story out now?
Well, we've created an app that is a walking tour of Soldiers' Home, and it's available in a number of different formats. You can get it on the iTunes store. You can download it from the SaveSoldiersHome.org website, and you can take it around, and it will lead you around the complex and show you these really gorgeous, beautiful historic buildings.
Well, can you give me a mini tour, if you will,
sure.
here? So we've looked at the main building here. What would be something we would hear on the walking tour about this main building?
I think one of the things that you would hear is that this was built in 1876. It had a number of additions over the years as the needs of veterans became greater. As these Civil War veterans are aging, more of them need service. So the building has to expand to follow that population's needs. And that it was designed by Milwaukee architect Edward Townsend Mix, who was probably the most famous architect in Milwaukee at the time, one of the best architects in the state. I think one of the really interesting things about this is that they hired not just any architect to design this. They hired Milwaukee's best architects to work on this complex, which tells you something about the level of commitment they had to the care of veterans. They really wanted the veterans to get the best care in the best environment that they could.
So where did the idea for the walking tour come from?
Well, we wanted to be able to help people to appreciate the Soldier's Home complex. And the best way to do that is to allow them to stroll the grounds, because the part of the history of Soldier's Home, why it is where it is and why it looks the way it is that they recognized during the Civil War that they had to not just treat the body but the mind of veterans. So they created this beautiful landscape with all of these pastoral lawns and places to walk and places to relax and contemplate. So we wanted people to be able to get out here to appreciate the grounds and to see the architecture themselves. It's one thing to hear about the story of something. It's a whole other thing to see it. And so we wanted to have people be able to see in these buildings what we see, which is a great potential.
What's it like inside the buildings? You talked about how, especially in the main building, it was actually fairly well preserved. But I wonder, What do you see in there?
Well, if you go inside of the main building, you see something that looks probably a lot like an old school building. You see big, wide hallways. You see terrazzo floors, tile walls, large entrances, and then a series of rooms opening off of those hallways.
So where have we just arrived now?
We've arrived in front of the Soldiers' Home Chapel, built in 1888. It was designed by a Milwaukee architect named Henry Cook, who is probably most famous to people in Milwaukee as the architect of the City Hall and the Turner Hall buildings in the downtown. What we're looking at here is a wood frame, Queen Anne-style chapel building that's covered with shingles on the exterior and has beautiful leaded glass windows and a lot of ornate detail.
What would be something that we would hear on the tour about the chapel?
On the tour, you'd hear how this chapel was financed through donations of veterans themselves. The chapel was built using proceeds of fines from deserters, from money that came through the store here on the grounds. When people bought stuff, the proceeds from it, the profit, went to support the construction of buildings on the grounds, including beer sales, which I think will make a lot of Milwaukee listeners happy. There are so many of the original buildings here that you can really get a feeling like you're traveling back in time. You can get a sense of what this was like when it was teeming with Civil War veterans in the 1870s, 80s, 90s. It has such a well-preserved complement of buildings that it's one of the places in Milwaukee that seems like it's lost in time.
Well, where to next?
I think we'll head on next to the Wadsworth Library.
I can see the value of preserving these buildings for the historical society in terms of not just the physical buildings themselves, but the stories that go along with them. But ultimately, what will all of this attention to the Soldier's Home and its history bring to the modern day VA?
I think what it will bring to the modern VA is the ability to be able to reuse these buildings in a way that supports the mission of the VA. We understand that their mission is not to operate a museum, that their mission is the service of veterans and veterans' medical needs. So that's why we're working very closely with them to try to make sure that any possible reuses of these buildings that come up are allied with their mission.
How many buildings are being targeted for there are 26 sites. Are all 26 being targeted for rehab and preservation?
There are four buildings that are currently unused by the VA that we are focusing our rehabilitation efforts on.
And so then some of the buildings, most of the buildings on the tour, are actually currently being used by the VA.
That's correct. This is a very busy campus. The VA has an enormous operation here, so having these many buildings here allows them for the opportunity to put all of the administrative uses and other kinds of uses that are a necessary part of patient treatment in places other than the hospital itself and free up hospital space for patient treatment.
Well, so I believe we've finally arrived here at the Wadsworth Library. Tell us about this building.
Sure. The Wadsworth Library was built as just what it sounds like, a library for the service of the veterans who are staying here at the hospital. this shows, again, the interest in treating the body and spirit of veterans and not just their physical injuries. So they construct a library so veterans are able to educate themselves. It was part of the assimilation process for those veterans that would be returning to a more public life, and it was a necessary diversion for those who found themselves staying in permanent care here on the grounds.
And I see we've got some lovely Cream City brick here on the exterior.
Yeah, most of the buildings built on the complex are built of Milwaukee's own Cream City brick, so this yellow brick is everywhere in the complex, and it's a feature that defines all of the buildings here, virtually all.
Now, is this still a library?
This building's still being used as a library today, and it has some of the surviving details related to its use as a library. It has its terrazzo floors and plaster walls and a mezzanine area. Some of the original bookshelves that occupied the building are even inside yet today.
Now, obviously, we're not going to go to every stop on this tour. Yeah. I think we've hit a couple of really great main sites, but there are so many others to see. What's your favorite spot on the walking tour?
My favorite spot is actually the Ward Memorial Theater, which is just down the hill from where we are right now, which was built as a theater space for veterans. And I think what's really interesting is they finished the dormitory spaces to house the veterans, and then one of the first buildings they built after that was the theater, because they understood that veterans had to be entertained as well, and they had to provide something for them.
Now, obviously, some partners have gotten to see the inside of the building. What would we see if we were in there today?
If you walked inside of it, you'd see a large theater space that is very historic and very original to its appearance. They have original wrought iron theater seats with the bent wood backs and seats, ornamental plaster walls, murals, and a very large proscenium arch over theater performing space.
Is this building going to be similar to the chapel in the sense that the rehab, the reuse of this building will try to keep that original character, but it might be used for something completely different than its original purpose?
Yes, the intent is to reuse this building, but do it in such a way that we preserve the character-defining features of the theater so someone can recognize that it was a theater and see all of the special aspects of the theater design yet. This may be the first building to be reused of the buildings that are currently vacant. The VA is looking at some possible reuses of this that will not be performing reuses, but will serve their current patient needs.
So at the end of the day, Jim, what should Milwaukeeans know about Soldiers Home, what you guys are doing here, the walking tour? What should they know about these efforts?
I think what we want them to know is that they are part of the solution, that they can help by going to the Save Soldiers Home website, by coming to visit, by reflecting on what this complex means to them and sharing those thoughts with other people, and by being supportive of efforts to save this nationally significant site in Milwaukee.
Jim Draeger, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jim Draeger is State Historic Preservation Officer at the Wisconsin Historical Society. He took Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce on a tour of the grounds of the Soldiers Home at the VA Medical Center. You'll find more about it at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. That is Lake Effect for a Monday. I'm Mitch Teich. Special thanks to the veterans in our lives, including Lake Effect's own Bonnie North, WUWM's Bob Bach, along with Dan Harmon's father, Colonel David Hartman, and uncles Edwin Kleba and Daniel Kleba, Stephanie Lecce's grandfathers, Ed Lecce and Ed Minetta, and my grandfather, Jack Richmond, and my father-in-law, Gary Richter, and to all the veterans in the listening audience. Thanks to all of you for tuning in today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh Air is next.